Welcome to the Fundamental Health Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Saladino. This podcast is the result of my relentless search to understand and correct the roots of chronic disease and illness. In this podcast, I will share with you everything I have learned about how to live the most healthy and radical life possible. Thanks for joining me on this journey. What is going on, you guys? Happy Thanksgiving. Hope you guys all had an amazing day with your family and you did radical things wherever you are and appreciated all the blessings that we have. I am so excited for this week's episode, and I'm so excited to tell you that my book is now available for pre-order. You guys know this. You can go to thecarnivorecodebook.com to get a listing of the table of contents and all other cool stuff there. And then there's links there to pre-order it from the publisher directly. Also, this podcast is doing so good. We are spreading the truth to people. We are dispelling myths. That's what I am so passionate about. And the way that we do that is by getting good reviews so it reaches more people. So please, 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 if you can support me on iTunes and other places where you listen to this podcast, leave me a review. Let me know how I'm doing. We're getting close to 500. We're getting there, guys. Every week it gets into the top 10 in iTunes when it's released, and we are getting tens of thousands of downloads per week. We are reaching a lot of people. This is the movement. We are changing things and affecting lives positively. Last thing for me, if you are not a member of the Insiders, if you are not getting my newsletter, you are missing out. I talk about a study every week. I talk about what's going on with me. I talk about who's on the podcast, and it is worth your time. Check it out. You can go to carnivoremd.com and sign up for that amazing radical thing. Another amazing radical thing is my guest this week, Stan Efferding. Stan Efferding, you guys, the white rhino. He is an amazing individual, a pro professional bodybuilder, and a world record holding powerlifter. He's one of only 10 men in the world to ever total over 2,300 pounds raw in competition. That's a combination of multiple lifts, including deadlift, squat, and bench. And that is a feat of enormity, my friends. He is a really, really good guy in person. He is the founder of the Vertical Diet, which is basically the carnivore diet with rice. And we talked all about the work that he's done with strongmen, Halvor Bjornsson and Brian Shaw, whether or not he thinks they could do it on a ketogenic diet. I do. We talk about it. We talk about ins and outs of that, how we get fat, how we lose weight, whether we can include carbs in a healthy diet. You guys are really going to be surprised from this one. It was a great conversation. Stan is also offering a carnivore option for the vertical diet now, which is basically meat delivery, which is amazing and could help a lot from a convenience perspective for those of us that are busy. So you guys are going to dig this episode. I think you'll really like all the things we get into. And I know that you will love and continue to appreciate White Oak Pastures. They are such good sponsors of this podcast. They make it possible. They are the good people, you guys, down in Bluffton, Georgia, 150 years, six generations, grass-fed, grass-finished. They have so many amazing animals. They are carbon negative. The environment is not being harmed by eating ruminants, you guys. Do you know this? We need to change the world. People need to realize that eating plant-based food is not what the environment needs in any way, shape, or form, my people. So check out whiteoakpastures.com. You can use the code CARNIVOREMD for 10% off your first order. You can use the code CARNIVORE15 for whatever is on special that month, which you can see at info.whiteoakpastures.com/CARNIVOREMD, which is my landing page at White Oak Pastures. I hope to see you all at White Oak Chella later this month. That is happening. That is a super exciting thing. And the other cool stuff is Ancestral Supplements. These are my people down in Texas who continue to produce grass-fed, grass-finished organs, bone marrow, all kinds of good stuff that help us eat nose to tail. They are conveniently packaged in a gelatin capsule, which makes it so easy when we're traveling, if we can't get organs, or if we don't want to include them in our diet. As you guys all know, nose to tail is my jam. It is the way I think we should be eating, whether we are eating a mixed diet of carbohydrates, whether we are eating a carnivore diet. This is how we get the nutrients that have been left out for so long. Check out ancestralsupplements.com. You can get intestines, bone marrow, liver, brain. They're coming out with all kinds of new stuff soon, which is super exciting. Keep an eye out there. They have prostate. They have the male optimization formula. At ancestralsupplements.com, you can use the code SaladinoMD on their Shopify site for 10% off. As always, they are putting back in what their modern world has left out. They are a good group of people. Check them out on Insta as well. Give them a follow. They're doing great stuff, and I'm excited to see more of them sharing their lifestyle, because these are people who live the life, you guys. I've spent time with them. They are great friends of mine. They walk the walk. They talk the talk. They are doing amazing stuff. They are jumping in cold water, lifting heavy things, and being ancestral in everything in their life. These people believe this to the core, and they are helpful to us in such a great way in providing all of these supplements that make our lives better as well. So, okay, without further ado, you guys, on to the podcast this week. Enjoy the conversation with Stan Efferding, the man, the white rhino, and check out his stuff, stanefferding.com, the vertical diet, check out his meal delivery, and listen afterwards for what's going on with me this week. Stan, Damon, thanks for coming on the podcast, you guys. It's good to have you here. Thanks. You got to hold the mic up.
Thanks for having us.
You know, it's exciting to have you guys here. I've been hoping to connect with you, Stan, for a while, and Stan walks in the door. He barely fits in the door to my apartment, but he brings Damon. He says, "Well, Damon's the brains." And I said, "Yeah, right. I've heard you talk, Stan, but it'll be good. We get two big brains and a whole hell of a lot of biceps for this interview." So, you know, it's cool. A lot of my followers are in the carnivore space, right? And I mentioned that you were coming on the podcast, and they're all really excited for this conversation. I think our worlds overlap a lot. But for people that might be listening to this podcast that are not familiar with the bodybuilding world or your story, just tell us a little bit about who you are and where you came from, and how you told me before we started this podcast that you were 140 pounds, 145 pounds in high school.
Kind of where I came from. I was actually 140 pounds when I got to college. And after 2 years of training, I competed in my first bodybuilding show. I weighed 158. And throughout the course of my 30 years of competing, of course, I went from 140 as a freshman in college in 1985 to 305 pounds in 1995. And during that time, I was bulking up to get as big as I could to powerlift. And then I was dieting down to get just as shredded as I could to get on a bodybuilding stage. And I would turn around, I would do it again. Over and over and over and over again, back and forth for damn near three decades. I've been up over 300 pounds probably 10 or 12 times throughout the course of that time frame. And then I've dieted down to compete in bodybuilding, you know, originally at 158 pounds and eventually to get my pro card at 252 pounds on stage shredded. So I've really spent my entire life dieting in one direction or the other. Putting on as much mass as I can for strength performance and then dieting off as much fat as I can to maintain as much muscle tissue as possible. So my whole life was about eating and trying to figure out the best way to eat. Because as you know, when you gain weight, you potentially subject yourself to metabolic syndrome, which I experienced multiple times throughout my career. I got blood tests on nearly a monthly basis for the last 10 years of my competing. I have over 150 blood tests, but going as far back as to college, getting periodic blood tests when I could afford it and watching what happened with my blood work. And I've really enjoyed your podcast recently about blood work. And, you know, that's when I reached out to you about your blood work stuff. And I've been a real proponent of that, particularly for athletes that I trained throughout my career. And I used the blood work to try and tell me, am I doing this right or wrong? Obviously, performance was the primary goal. But behind the scenes, I could see if my body was suffering as a result. I did a Rhino's Rant once called, "If you want to be healthy, don't compete." And so I'm not contending that what I did, whether it was bodybuilding or powerlifting, was necessarily in pursuit of health. It was certainly for performance. It was for fitness, not health. Two different things. But I had to be careful to mitigate damage along the way, or I noticed that my performance would suffer. And so, as well as dieting, I used many different methods to diet throughout my career and found that some would cause metabolic adaptation and potentially hormone suppression. I saw it more in the women that I trained than the men. The hypothyroidism, the anemia, the amenorrhea, the hair loss, all those things with nutrient deficiencies. So in short, if I can say that now after my 20-minute description of where I came from, I've just been kind of a professional dieter and competitive athlete for damn near 30 years, but done it with a pretty rigorous tracking And so now I'm on the other end of this, trying to help others and say, hey, there's probably a better way to do that if you're experiencing these, you know, that's things that I experienced or my athletes have experienced that have helped them overcome. And that's kind of what my campaign is now. As it relates to the carnivore, I've found that it for me, and what I think my clients have experienced is two things. One, I as I said in my seminar, my Iceland seminar with Hafþór Björnsson, has over 3 million views now. The very first thing I opened and said was that if there is a superfood, red meat is it. It's not acai berry and it's not kale. If you had to survive on one thing and not just survive but thrive, it would be red meat. It would be ruminants. And secondarily, I found on top of that, that in terms of performance, that I thought that it was really important. And then what I was really thinking about here is for gut health. I had a lot of trouble with gut health throughout my career, a lot of problems. And so I just found that it was the ultimate elimination diet.
Oh, heck yeah.
Yeah. And so that kind of gets us to where we're at today. I think we're talking the same language. I throw a few extra things in for performance. But as far as what I think the most important thing is, it's certainly ruminants for health. I just think it's the best thing that you can do.
I think that story is so interesting, and we can maybe, you know, dig into that a little bit, different aspects of it, because a lot of people listening to this might not be bodybuilders or powerlifters, but I think that anyone listening to this needs to care about their lean muscle mass. And needs to understand how to maintain and grow lean muscle mass if they want, and how to be as strong as possible. I think that for every person listening to this podcast, whether it's a 60-year-old woman in Illinois, or a 25-year-old dude in Florida, or a 20-year-old woman in Washington State, like, maintaining lean muscle mass is what we need to do as humans, and I think is a fantastic metric for overall health, right? If we're looking at someone and we're, you know, people will talk about skinny fat or sarcopenia, mm-hmm. this loss of lean muscle mass tissue. Muscle is an organ of longevity, and other people have said this. I'm not the first person to say that. And so
Gabriel Lyons, there's a lot of people in the industry
who have said that. And I think that's why your experience is so valuable. And people who are at the pinnacle of gaining and maintaining muscle mass can teach us so much about this and understand so much about how to maintain this organ. You know, I talk a lot about nose-to-tail carnivore. And in the nose-to-tail carnivore diet, I think of organ meats, right? But it's really a misnomer. The muscle is an organ, the fat is an organ, the liver is an organ, the pancreas is an organ, the brain is an organ. And so what's interesting for me about a carnivore diet is getting all the organs to work. But if we're just talking about muscle as an organ, muscle is hormonally active. Muscle is something that affects us so profoundly in our lives. And to lose it is to become unhealthy.
Yeah, yeah. And I do talk a lot about, you know, bodybuilding, powerlifting, muscle in general, figure, physique, bikini. But the vast majority of people that Damon and I work with and have worked with over the last couple of years since releasing the Vertical Diet are your dad bods and soccer moms. And it's still a priority for them for so many reasons, as we mentioned earlier, in terms of the micronutrient density. Then people go on diets and start eliminating a lot of things that they shouldn't. They start eating egg whites, they start eliminating red meat. Next thing you know, they've got choline deficiencies and biotin deficiencies, and they've got, again, iron deficiencies and B12, and they're at the doctor getting a shot for what? Iron and B12 and D3 and all the things that they could be eating and should be eating but have been demonized. And I focus on muscle. Obviously, we have we put a lot into adequate protein intake, but we focus on muscle for all the very reasons that you said, because it provides them more energy, obviously a better body composition. So as they lose weight, they can maintain a better basal metabolic rate. So those are the things that we hone in on. And we have a very deliberate hypertrophy style training program that we like people to implement, because it has so much. It's the stimulus, which is really important, that you create the right stimulus so you can then partition nutrients towards muscle, as opposed to muscle wasting, which most people seem to experience when they diet.
Yeah. We should dig into that. And I love what you said in your explanation of sort of where you've been about, there's almost this dichotomy between powerlifting and bodybuilding, right? That if you want to look shredded and you want to get down to a very, very low body fat percentage, that may not result in the most strength or the best performance. And the reverse may be true as well. Obviously, you know, if you want to get the most performance, you may not always have the lowest body fat. There's certainly many examples that people will be familiar with of people getting too lean, like you said, and becoming hypogonadal or little, you know, too low in terms of their hormones. So in terms of what you've seen over your career training people, what are some of the biggest pitfalls that people run into, you know?
Yeah. And I kind of through the intro, when you're trying to gain mass, people tend to overeat. They start to get over fat. They start to experience metabolic syndrome. They start to get fatty liver disease, insulin resistance, and those kinds of things. And then, of course, they start partitioning nutrients towards fat. This is when Hofthor Bjornsson reached out to me 3 years ago. And the very first thing he said to me is, Stan, I'm getting fatter. I'm not getting stronger. And I immediately knew what the problem was. I've lived it many, many times. I've dirty bulked up to over 300 pounds and been a fat ass and experienced the same problems. I had some high iron. I had some high blood pressure. I had some high blood sugars. I had fatty liver. I had some increased AST, ALT enzymes. I mean, I saw all those things in my blood work. And some of it you would semi-tolerate for a short period of time as a, you know, as the consequence of succeeding at the level that, that I was able to succeed. But you knew that you couldn't do that all the time. You know, you had to fix those problems. And then on the other end of the spectrum with the figure and physique of bikini competitors, even myself when I was bodybuilding and I would over-restrict, I would find myself becoming extraordinarily tired, suppressed hormones. Just recently, the woman that was running for Nike ended up with the female triad and she broke five bones as a result of being anemic and then having low estrogen and therefore having bone density problems.
Over-restricting calories.
Over-restricting calories and running too much and not giving herself the right kinds of foods. But that generally, dieters find themselves, I think they should be looking towards a healthy, sustainable type of program, but they end up finding themselves creating these deficiencies, the estrogen suppression, you know, and then the bone mineral density loss, etc. So those are the things I find the most. I want to take just a second here because I didn't introduce Damon yet to our audience. this is the brains of the operation, actually, as you mentioned earlier. Damon's a registered dietitian, PhD, candidate in exercise phys, just has to finish his thesis here. And I'll let him finish. He was also head of the dietetic department at UNLV, and we connected about a year ago. And we've gone through every aspect of the vertical diet and really kind of brought it up in terms of he attached over 200 peer-reviewed published research articles. And so, you know, I wanted to make sure we got him in on the conversation here.
We will,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Hofthor, because people will know Hofthor as the mountain in Game of Thrones, right? Some of my audience may not be familiar with strongmen. You know, we'll probably talk a little bit about Brian Shaw and Hofthor Bjornsson, who are two of the strongest people in the world that you train, right?
Yeah.
So this is quite a feather in your cap. And so what was Hofthor doing wrong when he was fat but not strong?
A few things. Some of the same things I did. We ran a blood test, of course. We found vitamin D deficiency. We found a little bit of high blood sugars. At that size, you generally suspect there's going to be some fatty liver disease. Mm-hmm. They tend to eat too much of the wrong foods, a lot of pizza, pasta, pancakes. I think, and I will always claim that the source of that problem is vegetable oils, seed oils. I think that when those are consumed in excess, it creates an environment for the extra carbohydrates, particularly sugars, to create fatty liver disease. And we found that with at least some research has suggested that in the absence of those seed oils that you're much less likely to experience a lot of these metabolic syndrome problems and high blood sugars, etc. He was low in vitamin D, so we got him supplemented with that, which also helps with blood sugars. There's an inverse relationship between insulin sensitivity and vitamin D. We saw that in the Finland study nationwide, their countrywide, they found that it dramatically decreased diabetes in children as well. And so they started putting vitamin D into some of their foods and they had a dramatic decrease in diabetes for children. Another thing was just a CPAP. The vertical diet isn't just about a diet. It's about all the lifestyle things that go in sleep and very, very, probably the most important thing. I found out he wasn't wearing a CPAP. He's a 425-pound man. I started experiencing problems with sleep apnea when I got up to about 230, 240. Needless to say, when I was 260, 70, 80, 90, 300, it was severe. And I, since the early 90s, I've figured that out and I bought a CPAP and started wearing it. Of course, back then it was the CPAP, the constant pressure. It's like driving down the freeway with no windshield. You just all night long, you know. And nowadays they're really good machines. So we definitely got him a CPAP, which dramatically helps blood pressure. People always talk about sodium, but CPAP can lower blood pressure by up to 20 millimeters in the systolic blood pressure measurement. Sodium-sensitive people might experience a 2 to 7 millimeter increase, you know, and even then, if you satisfy their potassium needs, that will go away. So that was a huge deal. So we had to diet him down. We had to take about 7% of his body weight off. That's from what the literature seems to suggest. That's the amount of weight that will give you a pretty significant benefit in terms of blood sugar and health outcomes and blood pressure. So we took him from 425, 435 down to about 390.
Through just caloric restriction and changing the quality of his foods.
Yes, for those two things. And got some more choline into his diet, which is huge for the liver. We get 1,000 milligrams of choline a day. So I'm a big proponent of getting 6 eggs a day, whole eggs, because of the choline primarily in improving blood sugars. So we did that. And then we were able to, I implemented the 10-minute walks, which has been huge for us and our clients. And it's something that we've been really adamant about. It's very sustainable. It's twice as effective as metformin for blood sugar control. It's been studied extensively to show that HA1C and type 2 diabetes is much better managed with regular exercise, and specifically with respect to 10-minute walks is their post-meal, and they're frequently throughout the day. And so you can get insulin down and get those blood sugars out of the bloodstream, and the muscles can take up the blood sugars. So it's another great reason why the carnivore diet is so effective with people with diabetes and high blood sugar. And so we fixed all those problems, and then we were able to take him back up, keeping the choline in the diet and not eating the seed oils and the pizza pasta pancakes. And he got all the way back up to 455 pounds when he competed at the Arnold. And he had, your audience will probably appreciate or understand these numbers, but he had a fasted glucose of 83. He had an insulin of 4.5, I think. It was under 5.
Fasting insulin?
A fasting insulin.
That's amazing.
He had an HA1C of 5.1. It was better than mine. I was kind of upset at him. 5.1 at 455 pounds, and his blood pressure was much improved. And C-reactive protein was under 1. It was like 0.6, which is really extraordinary for someone of that size. So I'm not claiming... Yeah, he almost had abs. I'm not claiming that powerlifting and strongman are healthy sports, but a lot of what I do and what I had to do throughout my career, what I do with my clients now, and not even athletes, but ordinary folks who are obese or what have you and have the same metabolic syndrome, is mitigate damage as best I can to try and get them to implement some simple lifestyle changes consistently. I didn't talk about running marathons here. I'm not talking about starving yourself. And get the right micronutrients into the diet and eliminate, yes, some things that I know that folks hate that word, elimination. But we do. We eliminate some things that are more likely to cause these problems, whether it's the food themselves or just the fact that some people may overconsume them. And that's kind of how I was able to help Hawthorne and a number of other athletes that experienced the same problems that I did. And Mark Bell did, and we did the same with him. And got him healthy from he was over 300 pounds and had a lot of the same problems. His blood pressure was 196 systolic blood pressure at one point. And you just kind of, in that industry, you put your head in the sand. You're just blindfolded because you're focused on the 600-pound bench press. You don't care what the blood pressure is. And I'm here to say that you can actually improve performance if you step back, heal yourself, and go back at it another way. I use this kind of what I call deloading, like you would do if you were weight training. If you're powerlifting, you can't lift heavy all year round. You just start to break down. So I kind of deload body weight. I ask people to step back and get insulin sensitive so they can start partitioning their nutrients towards muscle again, lose a little fat, and stimulate the body so that you can go back at it again and use that kind of one step back, two steps forward methodology.
I love it. I think that you hit on some really, really key points here that I think one of the main drivers of insulin resistance, which is probably what most of these people are suffering from, Mark Bell, who's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds like Hawthorne was insulin resistant.
Yeah.
And I think at the most basic level, processed vegetable oils are a huge culprit here.
Yeah.
And I think that we're trying to figure out which type of carbohydrates might cause this, and we can get into the gut issue. Mm-hmm. I think there are other things. I talk a lot about insulin resistance on my podcast and in my book, which I'm just finishing up. And I think that the main drivers of insulin resistance are oxidative stress and inflammation for most people. And probably, certainly sleep deprivation could do it in somebody that's 400 pounds. Once you get to be that big and you get that much muscle around your neck, I would imagine it's pretty hard to have a posterior pharynx that stays open while you're sleeping. So, so I think that the three biggest drivers for people are probably sleep deficit, inflammation, which can be connected with the gut, which I know you're super excited about, and we're going to talk about that, and oxidative stress, which is where the processed oxidized vegetable oils tie into it. So pulling those out of his diet was probably a big deal. I love that you talked about choline. Choline has been demonized for TMAO, but as I've talked about on multiple podcasts, the conversion of TMA in the intestines to TMAO is really mediated by an enzyme in the liver called FMO3, which is insulin dependent. So if people are not insulin resistant, they don't tend to have a lot of TMAO. And I was just looking at this really cool blood work from one of my clients who's on a carnivore diet. Her TMAO is rock bottom. It's like 1.5, right?
Right.
The lower limit, the limit they want is less than 6.5. She's 1.5, completely breaks the model that everybody is saying, you know, about TMAO. So we need, I'd love to hear your take on TMA too, Damon, but we need choline in our diets. And as people may know from our previous podcasts, choline is used to make phosphatidylcholine, which helps get fat out of the liver. And if we're choline deficient, we get NAFLD, right?
Yeah.
We get non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So if he, if he was, you know, insulin resistant, potentially because of oxidative stress from the vegetable oil and choline deficient, you got a real problem here.
Yeah.
And you really, that's awesome that you were able to step in so precisely and correct that. And then he had such great results. And I love it that there was such a big difference there. And then you mentioned Mark Bell. When people are insulin resistant, that's the major driver of hypertension too.
Yeah.
And so when we can correct the insulin resistance, the hypertension gets better.
Yeah. That's the damage for the endothelial layer of the blood vessels. And that's what starts the problem. People are chasing cholesterol, but that's, again, the fireman for the fire.
Yeah.
And so we didn't demonize cholesterol for that reason. We tried to address the actual makers, not the markers. And what we ended up doing was getting him healthy to where he had less concern about that. People are concerned about cholesterol, but the studies show that over and over again, that when you just about everybody seems to be on board with that now. Even our vegetarian friend Walter Willett at Harvard has said that it's cholesterol in the diet is not it doesn't necessarily end up as cholesterol in the blood. I think we're getting finally being able to close the door on that myth. Slowly, there's a few hangers on out there just because they don't want anybody eating eggs because it's an animal product. But we can't keep allowing people with an ethical concern to try and turn that into a health initiative. It is what it is. We're probably never going to win that battle. But I just want my clients to. The challenge is that it is of such benefit, particularly even for women who are dieting, that if they have this misconception that it's bad for them somehow, that they won't eat it.
Cholesterol, you mean?
Cholesterol and saturated fat even as well, and red meat. And we go on to talk about dairy. I think the first time I reached out to you was to question about calcium, because I tend to be a dairy fan, whether it be yogurt or cheese or, maybe ultimately. And I think I asked you, would a nose-to-tail carnivore think that, say, a canned salmon with a bone in be the next solution down? If you weren't inclined to have dairy, would you end up with canned salmon or sardines bone in? In order to get that calcium, because that's a huge component too, particularly for women. And people think it's just for bones, but it's not. It's for nerve signaling. It's for muscle fiber contraction. It's huge how important calcium is in the diet. And so I try and make sure I get it into all of my people's diets. And those people who are in the carnivore industry, that's when I reached out to you initially about calcium. So if you remember that.
Yeah, calcium is an interesting one. I recommend bone meal from, animals that are well fed and are known, low levels of lead. I do think we need calcium, and I think it's something we shouldn't ignore on a carnivore diet. There certainly are some interesting studies that suggest that when you have high protein, the absorption of calcium from the intestines increases. And I think ultimately, if we can look at certain markers in the blood, to see if we have adequate calcium, I would look at PTH,
parathyroid hormone and want it to be like the lower half of the reference range, and then look at serum calcium. And then you can also look at, if you really wanted to, you could look at bone turnover with like N-telopeptide. But I always, with my clients and when I'm talking about the carnivore diet, I do think we need a source of calcium. For me, dairy never worked. Man, I wanted it to work,
right,
Stan.
Right.
I wanted and it to
work. It's
so
it's
bad.
Interesting because people will demonize dairy based on the folks that are either lactose intolerant or have a whey allergy. And if you're testing those folks, yes, you're going to get adverse results. You're going to get inflammation. You're going to get gut dysbiosis. But that's similar to saying if somebody has a peanut allergy that you should then nobody should eat peanuts. And so for those people who tolerate it, there seems to be some good research that suggests that it can improve cardiovascular disease and body composition. And that could be a benefit for some people. And it's kind of, we try not to be too dogmatic with the vertical diet. And you know, I came out of the gates because I'm that kind of guy, you know, and Damon's like, well, and he's the sensible one. He's the pragmatic one that's like, I don't know if you can really say that. And then he'll show me the research and I'm like, ah, damn it. You know, I really wanted to, you know, hang my flag on that. But, you know, what we've tried to do is say that first and foremost, all diets work when they're strictly adhered to, and the weight loss, the initial weight loss, is really the most important initiator for health, for improving health. And we saw that with the McDonald's diet and with the Twinkie diet and the 7-Eleven diet. And although we'd never recommend those diets, those people did dramatically improved all of their blood markers for health. You know, their blood sugars, their blood pressure, their cholesterol all improves with the weight loss, irrespective of the diet they're on. That included eating McDonald's every day. Not our best choice, you know, particularly not as athletes or people who want to perform well. And then we also say that compliance is what's most important, and that weight loss. That doesn't mean that people can't lose weight and have a terribly deficient, you know, micronutrient deficient diet and end up suffering, you know, manifesting long-term problems like
vegan diet.
Yeah, that would be the one. Or these, you know, really restrictive bikini girl diets with the egg whites and white fish and broccoli, and they end up with all sorts of deficiencies. And the 500 calorie HCG diet, and the list goes on. But, you know, the caveat being, as long as you're getting adequate micronutrients, which is harder to do with the more restrictive calories. I don't see too many guys having micronutrient deficiencies because they eat significantly more calories. And so they tend to get, you know, a larger variety of those things, with women in particular. And then we go on to say that once you've achieved the weight loss and you have a lifestyle of something that's sustainable, we say simple, sensible, and sustainable, and we've made sure they got adequate micronutrients, then it's really individualistic, it's dose dependent, and with some foods it can be cumulative in nature. So we're kind of cautious to let the individual drive the process. If someone has significant autoimmune disorders from digestion problems, then we're going to the ultimate elimination diet. We're going carnivore. You know, we're telling them, here's your ribeyes and your salmon and your whole eggs and some liver and, you know, here's what you need. And that's a great start. We do like to reintroduce, but we're somewhat cautious about whether or not that creates problems long term. It's the way my wife grew up in Samoa, in Western Samoa. I did a video called I don't even remember what I called it, but I think it was like something about the fattest people in the world, which has been studied extensively for many, many years. I think it was what was the name of the college that Brown University has spent a considerable amount of time down there studying the diets of the Samoan Islands. And I talked at length through what I thought really happened there, what transpired as a result of food stamps making it to American Samoa. And then and along with that, people stopped growing their own food and ended up buying the three most terrible things you can buy, which is what's affordable and available, readily available, which was vegetable oils, white flour, and sugar. And that's what they could get in mass quantity, and that's what they ate the most of, and it just accelerated their obesity. But my wife grew up in a small village in Apia in Western Samoa. She lived there till she was 26, and they would grow all their own food. They raised goats and chickens, and they went out to the ocean, and they harvested whatever they could eat, and they ate all of it. The eyeballs. She was just describing to me how her mom would squeeze everything out of the intestines, and then she would cook those, and the family would eat all of that stuff, I'll say. There wasn't anything that... And when I went there, and we went to the... They have a a place where they sell, everybody gets together, kind of a, would you call that like a Sunday market or something? They have a marketplace where there's like four generations of family there. And most of the families have 10 or 12 kids, as my wife's family has 12 brothers and sisters. And her brother has seven kids and still lives in a four-post grass hut with no running water and no bathroom. They go outside to a hole dug in the ground, and they have a pipe coming from the stream that they use to shower, and they sleep on reed mats on the dirt floor. And when I visited them, they're still harvesting food from the ocean, and they're taking it to the market and selling it. And there were all these jars full of, I didn't know what they were. There was squid and octopus and eyeballs and just stuff that I didn't even think was edible. But it was awesome to see. It was pretty thriving in Western Samoa because they did not have food stamps. They still have to grow their own food, the majority of them. But in American Samoa, when the food stamps came in, all the farming went away. And everybody started buying those processed foods. And then, obviously from there, the obesity. And her father passed away from complications of diabetes as a result. And growing up, they were never overweight. She said, my dad was never overweight until that happened.
The processed food, it's like Weston Price all over again, you know?
Yeah, and that was pretty fascinating because I've read Weston A. Price's stuff, and I've listened to hours and hours and read Mary Enig's stuff and Sally Fallon's. And it's fascinating because hearing my wife's story and being to the islands and seeing the marketplaces and the farms and the foods that they ate. My wife's the healthiest person I know. She hardly ever gets sick. And if she does, like 4 hours later, she's like, I'm fine. She's never had a cavity. Her teeth are perfect. She has that square, full jaw. It's awesome. And I keep hearing, and she keeps telling me about, and I keep seeing that she grew up on all of the Weston A. Price style foods that they harvested themselves. And whether or not we can get there, I don't know. I started this conversation by saying all diets work and, McDonald's is fine. And I end up, you should raise your own chickens and goats and harvest your own salmon from the ocean. So
I think that there are lots of examples of indigenous people who eat a variety of foods who are pretty healthy. And I was actually having this conversation with my friend Tommy Wood, who people who listen to this podcast will know Tommy really well. And there's a really interesting thing that kind of happens with indigenous diets if we look at them. And it is that generally they're either high in carbohydrates or fat. They're not usually high in both. And if you look at people will point to the Catavans or the Tavaruans mm-hmm. and say they eat a lot of carbohydrates and they're healthy. And in the controlled feeding experiments that I was talking about with Tommy, we can put people in metabolic wards and overfeed them on bagels, pure carbohydrates, and they don't gain weight. But if you add a certain amount of fat, right? If you cross the threshold of fat, and again, there's an asterisk here regarding whether the food is processed or not, but even with unprocessed food, I think it's kind of interesting that if we combine fat and carbohydrates, we gain weight as humans.
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. And that was one thing I didn't mention when you asked me what I did for Hofthor. I kept his fats lower. I took him from the fatty meats that he was eating. I go down to a top sirloin or a top round or a sirloin tip. I tried to get his fats down because I wanted to drive carbs for performance primarily. I don't do this with everybody. I do this with people who have an extraordinary workload and have an anaerobic performance requirement. But with him, that's what I did. I tried to bring his fats down lower, and then I ran his carbs way up. Otherwise, we get the same experience. I noticed that too. When you get fats and carbs going together, you're getting fat.
You're gaining weight. And I think that I just want to make this clear for listeners because it's such an interesting point that you can overeat fat without carbs and you won't gain weight, right?
Yeah.
So I've tried to do a high-fat carnivore diet. Don't gain weight, right? Don't gain weight at all. I've had friends, again, this is anecdotal, but my friend Nathan Owens, who's been with me here on the Ask Me Anything podcast, we've done the same overfeeding experiments. If we overfeed fat, now again, the quality of the fat is important. Without mm-hmm. carbohydrates, humans don't seem to gain weight.
Right.
But if we overfeed carbohydrates without fat, they don't seem to gain weight. The problem for humans appears to come when we overfeed or we do lots of fat and lots of carbs.
I agree. And I'll even, because I have this opposition to seed oils, I'll throw in there that again, that when we surpass a certain threshold, and I'm not sure if you've interviewed Tucker Goodrich or seen
No, I haven't had him on yet.
Yeah, it's fascinating to look at the history. And of course, the oiling of America with Mary Nita goes through the same process with respect to seed oils. But one of the studies in particular was done out of India, and it was an insurance company that had, I think it was 1.2 or 1.4 million insured, and they were kind of separated. They kind of drew a line between North and South India. And they found that the because of the religious convictions of the people in southern India tended to be the ones that wouldn't eat the red meat. They eat a lot more seed oils. They had 7 to 15 times more cardiovascular disease than the North that ate a significant more saturated fat. And I think that Dr. Salem Youssef's peer study also showed saturated fat to be protective, neutral to protective. And I think that one of the conditions of that would be, you know, whether or not you were sucking down a bunch of seed oils. And of course, we see the highest saturated fat consumers in the world, France and Switzerland, are both a couple of the lowest cardiovascular disease countries in the world. So I don't, you can't really, you know, continue to call those things, you know, anomalies anymore, because there's really good evidence to suggest that just the contrary.
So I think that the fascinating takeaway for me, and I'm glad that you brought up Haftor again, is that if people want to lose weight, we need to either restrict, and again, I don't want to make an extreme statement here, but I think that one very powerful lever for weight loss is restrict either carbs or fat. And I think you can do either. You know, I'm a big proponent of the carnivore diet for its effects on autoimmunity and inflammation, but I have no problem with people doing lots of carbs if they restrict fat, right? Yeah. And, you know, half of my audience is losing their mind right now. I don't do it. You know, I feel better in ketosis. And I want to circle back to this. I want to get Damon's thoughts on salt in a moment. But I think that, you know, humans can lose weight doing high carb, low fat, right?
Yeah.
You just have to be aware that you're going to miss the fat soluble nutrients, right?
Yeah.
And so I think it's totally possible and you can get great performance out of that. But so often that's not the case. Very few people can do low fat and high carb, right?
Yeah.
You have to be very disciplined, and so many of the foods we have fat and carbohydrates combined.
Yeah.
Maybe it's easier for people to do high fat, low carb, and which what we see in keto, but I think either one of them works. But if you combine fat and carbs, recipe for weight gain.
Yeah, I agree. And I worked with Nadia Wyatt, who took third in the Miss Olympia. She's a professional IFBB pro bodybuilder in one of the greatest competitions in the world. And historically, she had dieted on egg whites and white fish and broccoli. And she had always had problems with some hair loss and some anemia and amenorrhea. And she was tired and all those things. So I dieted her down, and I kept carbohydrates in her diet for performance. One of the most important things when I'm dealing with bodybuilders and powerlifters and strongmen is that the training stimulus continues to be at a really high level, so they're not losing strength or size. And that seems to be fueled better by the glycogen and the carbohydrates. So all I did is I started her out with New York steaks, and then I brought her down to top sirloin, and then I brought her down to sirloin tip. And here she was posting on her Instagram right before the Miss Olympia, just completely shredded from head to toe, just as lean as could be, that she was eating steak every single day right up until the show, which is, you know, in our industry, it's kind of an anomaly. People, you know, they don't do that. Unfortunately, again, we've exported that into the general population. We've got women that are afraid to eat red meat and don't understand. And probably a message that we should continue to send, that your audience obviously is aware of, but share the message that iron is hugely important, that B12 is hugely important. I put somebody on just a steak diet, their body composition is going to improve and their health. You know, obviously I'm being extreme about that. We'd like to throw in some salmon and some whole eggs, of course. But the fact is that should be the basis of the diet, not something that you get a 3-ounce serving twice a week. No, that's probably the driver is ruminants.
I love it. And then you build on that. And I love that you emphasize salt. So Damon, let's talk a little bit about salt, because I think this is so important. And I've gone back and forth on sodium. And I know that I think the sodium-potassium balance is super important. But what I've seen is that at higher salt consumption, I feel better. You know, I just do. And like you pointed out, Stan, I think so eloquently, some people are salt sensitive, but that salt sensitivity can probably be improved with adequate potassium. Is this what you found?
Definitely. And I think you guys are making a really good point that everything is contextual, right? Like everything you guys have talked about is put into context, right? If you're going to cut out fat, you're going to, you know, monitor you're going to drive your carbs. If you're going to cut your carbs, you can drive your fat a little bit more. So it's contextual to everything else that's going on. And I think sodium's the same way. So if you look at the literature, right, the NHANES studies, the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, it's the largest epidemiological study they've done. And they've analyzed the data three different times. And all three of them, they couldn't come to a conclusion that sodium was related to hypertension, even though that's what's taught all day long in school. And I'm sure you heard it in med school too. You
right know, after they told me fiber was needed to poop.
Right. So yeah, and I'm with you too. I mean, right now, personally, I mean, I'm taking in probably 14 to 15 grams of salt a day. So I'm
getting sodium chloride.
Right. So I'm getting roughly, 6 to 7 grams of sodium. But my blood pressure is below normal. I mean, it's like 114 over 70. I mean, it's nothing, crazy.
Right.
So,
right.
And I'm making sure I'm getting my potassium and calcium and magnesium and so on and so forth. So again, contextual, right?
Yes. It's the balance of the other minerals. And as I've talked about on previous podcasts, if we don't get enough sodium, we waste the other minerals.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if you're getting enough, so would you say from your perspective, and I think you guys would agree with this, you can get a lot of sodium as long as you're getting calcium, mag, potassium in our diet.
Definitely. You can drive sodium as long as in the context of everything, you're balancing everything out. And, it goes back to everything's dose dependent, right? And everybody's going to have a little bit different sensitivity to the dose that they're getting, which again goes back to context. So,
So you're getting 6 to 7,000 milligrams of sodium. And this is confusing for people. Sodium chloride is the salt, right? So we have to get rid of the chloride. And, Damon is saying he has, 13 to 14 grams of sodium chloride a day, which is probably I'm probably pretty close to that, maybe around 10 to 11. Mm-hmm. I don't weigh it out anymore. And so you're getting 6 to 7,000 milligrams of sodium. How much potassium do you think you're getting in a day?
I'm shooting for at least 4,700. I get really close to that, if not 5,000.
5,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right around that 5 gram point.
Yeah. And I think that most people do best when their sodium and potassium are at least in the ballpark.
Oh yeah, it's almost a 1-to-1, I would say.
Yeah. You're
pretty close anyway.
Yeah. It is interesting on a carnivore diet. Meat is pretty darn high in potassium.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that most of us can get a lot of potassium eating meat. I'm probably not getting 1-to-1 anymore if I'm doing 5,000 milligrams of sodium a day, but I'm probably getting 4,000 milligrams of sodium. 4,000 milligrams of potassium. So it's in the ballpark. And I think
that's better than most.
Yeah. And I think that the metric there is blood pressure, that if the blood pressure is normal, man, and the serum potassium is normal. Great. And if you want to check RBC potassium, if RBC potassium, serum potassium and blood pressure are all within normal, you're probably getting enough potassium.
Yeah.
Did you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, again, it's going to be individualistic, but I would agree with you. If everything is in line and all the markers are showing, that positive result, then yeah, probably you're good.
Yeah. I don't think there's any other hidden potassium deficit that I should be thinking of with my clients.
No, I can't think of any hidden mechanism.
Yeah. And we know that when we limit sodium too much, we get insulin resistant, and that is to conserve the sodium. And that could probably be anywhere from, I did a podcast with James D. Nicolantonio. That could be anywhere from below, 2,000 milligrams of sodium a day. I mean, that's a pretty, moderate amount of sodium. Even that might be not enough for our body.
I mean, those are the recommended amounts, right? 2,300 milligrams or less is what you're supposed to be
consuming. Sodium or sodium chloride?
Sodium is what the recommended is 2,300 milligrams or a teaspoon of sodium is the national guidelines, right? The standards. But I mean, if you're an active person, if you're an athlete, you might be sweating that out in an hour. If you're highly active and a larger person and you're a heavy sweater, I mean, that you lost your whole day's worth at that one shot.
One of the things that I talked to Mark and Chris Bell about was the pump, and they were like, oh, when I eat carbs, I get more of a pump. And I thought, I wonder if this is blood volume. I mean, obviously, glycogen in the muscles, and I want to come back to Stan and talk about glycogen a little bit, but the glycogen in the muscles, I think, can give us feeling a pump. But we can just take a teaspoon of salt before a workout with some water, and that'll increase your blood volume. I mean, James D. Nicolantonio has talked about that. That'll improve performance as well. So I think that it's something to think about for sure. And I love that you guys are emphasizing that.
Well, and sodium's helping to carry that carbohydrate into the cell. So the people that are eating more carbohydrates and really going after that pump, the sodium's going to help carry that in along with fluid. So yeah, you're going to get a bigger volumization of that cell. So.
Right. And then let's go back to glycogen. This is a fascinating issue. So I've always kind of wondered, when I was in Sacramento, they've got this cutout of Brian Shaw, Mark and Chris do at Super Training. And I was like, man, that guy's big. I wonder how that guy would do on a carnivore diet. So here's my theory, Stan. You can tell me if this is totally crazy. You guys can both tell me what you think of this. I think for a lot of people, from what I've seen, and again, most of this has been in endurance athletes rather than strength athletes, but there's a little bit of work in strength athletes. I know we've got this phosphocreatine system, right? And that's the explosive, mm-hmm. right? And we're going to get tons of creatine in our muscles eating a carnivore diet. Like my creatine stores are topped off, right? Because I'm eating 2 pounds right. of red meat a day.
Yep.
So I got lots of phosphocreatine. And then as we do intense exercise, whether it's, and I guess if they're doing strongman stuff, it's not quite like burst. You know, it's not 15 seconds. It might be carrying an Atlas stone or something.
Yeah, yeah.
It might be in the middle. But, you know, we're going to, before we can actually start generating ATP for prolonged muscle contraction through aerobic mechanisms, we're going to need to do anaerobic glycolysis to regenerate the ATP on the phosphocreatine, you know, and we can use creatine to recycle ATP, but we're going to need to regenerate the ATP as well for the creatine that's going to donate a phosphate group to the ATP. And there's two things that I think are really interesting here. A lot of that's going to come, the glycolysis is the breakdown of glucose, right? And the glucose has got to come from glycogen in the muscles. And some of these discussions, we have to make sure whether we're talking muscles or liver. But at least in ultra endurance athletes, when they're keto adapted, they show that muscle glycogen storage and repletion are equivalent between ketogenic athletes and high carb athletes. Have you seen this one? It's the FASTER study from Finney and Volek.
Yeah, yeah.
And so my thought was, I wonder if you took a strongman, granted there would be an adaptation period, but if glycogen replenishment is equivalent, right? And glycogen utilization is equivalent and glycogen storage is equivalent after they're keto adapted and they have the same amount of creatine and we're still doing glycolysis because they have glycogen to do glycolysis with, do you think it's possible that a strongman could be just as good with keto, with a ketogenic diet, if they were keto adapted, you know, 6 to 8 months. Now, granted, you know, Hoftor would have 6 to 8 months where he's subpar.
Right, right.
But what do you think of that? Possible? Or am I missing something?
Even with the endurance athletes, you mentioned keto adaptation. And so it's not like everybody would experience the same result. There are some folks tend to be better at utilizing carbohydrates and fats even after they've, you know, attempted to restrict carbohydrates for a while. They might not get the same endurance result. I think there's another component to strength, and that has to do with intracellular swelling. I don't think it's all just about whether or not you're using, you know, what energy source you're using. And I think the fact that the glycogen is going to hold 3 or 4 parts water and you're going to get more sodium, I think that's a component, because as you get fuller and you retain more water and you get that compression of the muscle cells against each other, I think that is critical for top end strength. I think there's a component there that can't be matched without the extra glycogen and water, just the swelling. And Damon could certainly probably explain that better.
Do you think there's more on a carbohydrate-based diet? I guess that's kind of what I'm wondering. I don't know if we have the experiments to show it, but I'm wondering if once you get keto adapted, could you get an equivalent amount of glycogen in the muscles? Because it looks like that from some studies.
I'm not certain. I'm going to hand that over. I just know how huge it is when we cut athletes for weigh-ins and what happens to their strength as a result of the deflation.
Sure, in that acute period.
Yeah, in that acute period. And secondarily, and Damon will talk more about this also, is that it seems that the glycogen depletion happens preferentially or first in the endoplasmic reticulum of the muscle cell, which is critical for triggering the release of the calcium ions that then fire the muscle contraction. And when that glycogen gets depleted, you may have liver glycogen, you may have additional glycogen stores available, but within the muscle cell itself, when that one gets depleted, it seems there is a decrease in contraction, and it could just be for top end strength. But as far as the alphabet soup goes, this has to go back to the PhD.
So I think when you look at endurance and strength, right, there's a full spectrum in both of those categories for athletes. And I think that's where these kind of conversations, we might not be asking the right question. Okay. And the reason I say that, so this is kind of on the same line as my research. So I'm looking at carbohydrate manipulation on resistance training. And what I've noticed in my collection is I'm using squatting. And so they do 5 sets of squats and I have them do the first three sets are 10 reps. The last two sets, they are taking the set to failure. And I've had a couple people that are able to take that set to failure. It's like a 3-minute set, right? So that's a lot longer than what somebody would usually be under load for. And so now I think the conversation turns more to muscular endurance under that load versus just strength for a 1 rep max, right? Because now we're talking about 70 reps or more, right? And I think the same thing happens in endurance athletes. And I think what Stan's talking about with that contractile force, I think that's where there's a lot, I don't want to say a lot less, I don't think that's the right word, but the force requirements or the contractile force requirement for the endurance athlete may not be the same as what it is for that strongman who's trying to do the 1 rep max. How much the glycogen matters for that, I don't know if we'll ever know that. Because I've gotten some pretty interesting and really surprising results with what I've done. it may not have the effect that we think it does. It may not be the glycogen, may not be the mechanism that we're looking for, I guess is my point, right? It might be something that's more neuro. So as soon as you start taking something into the mouth, whether you swallow it or not, you're starting to stimulate, you know, neuromuscular transactions. And so you might be able to have some excitability just by taking something in the mouth, even whether you swallow it or not. So it doesn't matter if you're a keto adapted person or you're, you know, carb loaded, maybe that's not the rate limiter.
It's just such an interesting question because, looking at the biochemistry, what it looks like to me and looking at the studies, and again, I want to see some studies in strength athletes, but I think that there's a possibility that when we get keto adapted, we could have the same amount of muscle glycogen that we do when we're carbohydrate based, right? But there's maybe even a 3 to 4, some of these athletes are 6 months into ketogenic diets. So I wonder, you know, because I'm looking at the biochemistry and I'm going, well, if I've got enough creatine and I can still do glycolysis, right? And I can regenerate the ATP and I can still, then I have glycogen in my muscle. And there are studies that show that ketogenic athletes have the same amount of glycogen or at least the same usage and replenishment. I'm thinking, wow, I bet that you could, I mean, and then it becomes the this is kind of the ultimate question that I don't think we know the answer to. Do you need carbs for the best amount of strength? And I think in the acute phase, we know that if you take somebody who's carb adapted and you limit carbs, absolutely, they're going to lose strength. But then the question becomes, if they stay carb limited, can they keto adapt, then could you get the strength, you know?
Right. And that's what, you know, you brought up with Hofstra, he would suffer for 6 to 8 months becoming keto adapted, right?
Exactly.
So yeah, his training is going to suffer for a year, right? Like, cause he didn't have the optimal training for 6 to 8 months that he may have had previous, but you're right. Like once he does that, is it possible? There's a lot of data to support that a really low carb diet, you know, the strength athletes can still perform just fine.
Maybe he'd even be better. That's what I'm always wondering, you know?
Right.
Maybe we'd make him even better.
Well, and you're probably the better person to talk about this, but as you look through the research, and we'll take a deeper dive into this ourselves because it's a very interesting question, stay focused on the fact that intracellular swelling, part of the hypertrophy isn't just mechanical loading, it's the pressure of the muscle cells against each other mm-hmm. that creates another adaptative response that's wholly different than the mechanical loading process. And so, you know, I look at it from a practical standpoint. I noticed that when I'm swollen and heavier and more water retentive, that I'm definitely stronger. And I can see that, you know, just from the amount of water I'm holding, the amount of weight on the scale, and, you know, your bench press goes up and down with body weight. They say it's not necessarily that you've added a ton more cross-sectional area to your muscle that's going to translate into that, you know, single rep performance, but your full, you know, anytime you get dehydrated and over 2% of your body weight, you're going to have a significant decrease in performance. I think, you know, conversely, that when you're swollen and well hydrated, and that's why I throw a lot of salt and water at powerlifters and strongmen right before they compete, and white rice, because they just suck it all in and they gain a few pounds and then they go out and they have that extra gear in terms of top end strength.
I think that the simple experiment would be to take somebody that's keto adapted, and you'd probably have to have two people that are fairly similar body composition and sports, And take two people, one person that's keto adapted, one person that's not, and look at muscle glycogen stores, because that's kind of what we keep coming back to.
And then
to.
Throw salt and water at them and see if you can...
Yeah, see if it changes anything.
Yeah.
I think that the hypothesis, which may be completely wrong, is the question, not even a hypothesis, is what would a keto adapted strongman be like? And could they be even better? Maybe they would recover better, you know, or have, because we know that once you get to be keto adapted, your fat oxidation goes through the roof.
Yeah.
Right. And you can use different fuels. You can use your fat so much more efficiently. Maybe, and there's benefits in terms of mitochondrial production, turning on mitochondrial genes. It's just this question, like, what if we could make, you know, what is it, Steve Austin, the $6 million man?
Yeah.
What if we can make Steve Austin, you know, the strong man into a ketogenic man, but it just takes 4 months of tinkering in the lab with ketogenic diet. Who knows?
A lot of what I talk about is from personal experience. And then we matched it, married it to the research and tried to find, you know, what would work for the greater population. Although, again, it's individualistic. We have to do a lot of collaboration and feedback from clients. And I can't say that I did keto for longer than 90 days at any stretch. I mentioned I bulked up and dieted down many, many, many times over the course of 3 decades to compete. And many times I did under 50 grams of carbs. And I always experienced a loss of strength and a significant loss of energy. Of course, I was at a calorie deficit throughout that time because I was dieting.
Right.
But I don't think I ever really became adapted. And then I've dieted for shows on 4 pounds of steak and 600 grams of white rice. And maintained a lot more strength and size and fullness and energy throughout that process. That worked for me. But again, that was a 3-month experiment. That wasn't a 6-month experiment with a calorie maintenance calories or a calorie surplus.
Eucaloric.
Very different.
Yeah. What would happen if you did eucaloric or, you know, extra calories in a ketogenic state, whether it's carnivore or carnivore-ish?
Like, right.
I'm just curious because people always ask me that. I think I have a lot of listeners who are, they're carnivore curious, or they want to do a carnivore diet, but they're strength athletes. And I get that, you know, and they say, is this going to affect my strength? And my best answer is, I think it will in the short term. And then I think you'll get back to baseline. And I've seen that anecdotally. People will say that, once I got keto adapted, I was all good. But in the short term, whether it's jujitsu or whatever you're doing, you're going to keto adapt. You're going to be a little crappier, and then you're going to get that extra gear and you'll come back. Whether or not you're going to be better than carbs is questionable, but then the ultimate question becomes, why are you doing a carnivore diet in the first place? You know, kind of like we've talked about, I think there's utility to carbohydrates, and I don't think that non-processed carbohydrates are necessarily bad, as long as we think about the context, like you said, Damon. And people have to remember that if you're doing a lot of carbs and you're doing fat, you're going to gain weight.
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
So you can only choose one or the other.
Yeah.
And I think that we talked about that. So let's just talk about that other macronutrient, because I'd love to get your take on this. So we talked about carbs and fat, right? And we sort of said, I think you can do one or the other, but you can't do both if you want to be ideal. And maybe I'm, you know, oversimplifying that. Perhaps you could, but certainly I think that's important. But what about protein? How much protein should people get? You know, what's your take on this? Because I think a protein is building blocks, fat or carbs as alternate fuels.
Yeah.
So what's your take on protein? How much should people get? And is it the same on a weight basis as it is for, you know, a casual athlete as like a performance athlete? Or how do you counsel people in terms of protein consumption?
Yeah, in terms of performance, it seems like the literature suggests that about 1 gram per pound will give you about all the hypertrophy benefit that you're going to ever benefit from. It's not to mean you couldn't eat more, but you probably wouldn't gain any more muscle.
You won't get anything. That's what I've always thought, that 1 gram per pound is about the upper end.
About the upper end, yeah. But if I've got someone dieting and I want to maintain lean body mass at a calorie deficit, I'm going to push them up to 1.2 or 1.3 grams per pound for a couple of reasons. One, the satiety effect, the thermic effect of food, so they can eat more and not get as many net calories out of that food consumption, and they're not as hungry. And maybe at the calorie deficit, their body might require a little bit more. It's not a building thing. It's a prevention of loss in that condition. And if I, from my own experience, which come to find out the research supports now all these many years later, wish I knew it back when we didn't have the internet, when I started competing and the guy behind the front desk at Gold's Gym was giving me advice, eating tuna fish and rice cakes, I learned that, you know, at times I tried 2 grams per pound because I thought the more protein I ate, the bigger I was going to get. Just the opposite happened. It became damn near impossible to gain weight. And my condition was I needed to gain weight. I was undersized. And so now the recommendation that we make is that you actually lower protein, 0.8, 0.7 grams per pound, to free up some room for fats or carbs. In our case, carbs, because we're working with hypertrophy athletes, and we want to give them an opportunity to utilize those carbs for building muscle. And that way we can give them more calories and they can actually eat it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I think that Jose Antonio's research from the ISSN also showed that with protein overfeeding, that as a comparative number of calories from fats or carbs, you'd gain weight. But with protein overfeeding, you didn't.
No. Yeah. You don't gain weight with the protein.
That's right. And, some people are concerned about what about the kidneys? And it's been debunked as well with his research. They went up to, I think, over 2 grams per pound there and didn't find any adverse effect on urea and nitrogen and kidney function. Yeah. In people who didn't have pre-existing kidney conditions.
And what I've seen with protein, and sometimes people will text me or send me a message on Instagram, they say, oh, my creatinine went up. And I say, have your doctor get a cystatin C and repeat the creatinine. Because if you suddenly intake a whole bunch more meat on a carnivore diet or even on a vertical diet and you're eating, you know, say you're eating a half pound a day or even a half pound a few days a week, and now you're eating a pound a day or 2 pounds a day, you have all this creatine, right?
Yeah.
And that can get broken down into creatinine. And creatinine is not a direct measure of kidney function,
no,
right?
No.
It's a substance that's a waste product of creatine, and it's, you know, it's not a perfect measure of kidney function but what we're looking at is how much of that the kidneys are getting rid of, right? It's not like a byproduct of kidney damage, creatinine is. So if people have a creatinine bump on a carnivore diet, I would say have your doctor get a cystatin C and or repeat a creatinine, because I think that the majority of the time people are not having any issues with more protein on a higher protein diet.
And I think before we get off of protein, it's important to mention that I think that the quality of the protein matters. It's not just protein.
I love it.
Some people will throw egg whites at protein and think that they're good. But the studies have been done where they compared protein intake between an egg white protein and a whole egg protein and found that the whole egg protein individuals had a significantly improved hypertrophy and strength response. And the hypothesis was that the micronutrients mattered. And I would say the same thing, and the yolk, of course. And I would say the same thing with respect to why I choose red meat over something like turkey, which has a 17-1 or 25-1 omega-6 to omega-3 ratio and inferior iron and B12. And so I push ruminants over these monogastric soy-eating animals because I think that the micronutrient density, including the 6-1 ratio or 6-3 ratios, are far better.
I would agree with that completely. And I've seen that in my own life. I mean, since going carnivore a year and a half ago, I haven't even looked at a chicken.
Yeah.
I just have no interest. And it makes sense, right? If we think of plants as survival food, man, what is a chicken? That's just like, that's garbage.
Yeah. And I'm really cautious. I hate to be, you know, such a zealot, but I'm cautious to say, look, if you like chicken, eat chicken. It does have protein. It does have but when I go into the gym, and I'll turn this back into bro science here because I'm the bro. When I go into a gym and I see a leg extension and I see a squat rack, I know where I'm headed. I'm headed to the squat rack because I'll get more results from that. You know, other folks might sit down and put the pin in and start doing this and feel like they got a good workout. I feel the same way about some of the foods I choose. I want the ones that give me the biggest return on my investment, particularly for if you're dieting, because as we mentioned, you're much more susceptible to being micronutrient deficient. And, you know, not to transition out of protein, but this begets a pretty important conversation about cheat meals, if it fits your macros, 80-20. As you start to calorie restrict and deviate from the foods that have the most micronutrient density, you have less opportunity to get your 4,700 milligrams of potassium, your adequate choline and B12 and iron. And so you have to be really careful, depending on who you're working with and what the total number of calories is they're consuming, they can get adequate micronutrients, because that can have a huge impact on body composition, which is what most people are chasing.
Yeah, and I think that we're having almost two conversations here at once. You know, we're having the weight gain conversation and the weight loss conversation, so we can differentiate them for people. But if we talk about weight gain, I would love to get your perspective on this. And my friend, Thomas, who's going to come on the podcast soon, is going to love me for asking you this. What about hard gainers? You know, from your experience.
Well, that was me.
Yeah, really?
Yeah. I was 140 pounds in college. I wrestled 98 as a freshman, 98 as a sophomore, 106 as a junior, 115 115 pounds as a senior in high school. Now, a lot of that was I had really shitty diet and shitty sleep. I was working late into the evening, the swing shift. I wouldn't get home till 1 o'clock in the morning, back up at 6 a.m. I was trying to wrestle. I was eating McDonald's, or at the time I was working at 7-Eleven. I was eating those chips with the pump cheese, you know, and soda pop. Oh, it was terrible. And then, interestingly enough, the middle of my senior year, I went back to my grandfather's place in Pennsylvania, and my uncle owns a farm there, and I worked on his farm throughout that winter. And I started drinking raw milk from the dairy next door, the kind with the cream on the top that you had to shake just to get the cream to mix. You know, it was really fresh, which always disappointed me when I went and got raw milk up in Utah. I'm in Vegas. In Nevada, they don't allow raw milk. So I drive up to Utah and get raw milk, but there was no cream on the top. And I'm like, hey, what is this? I've been ripped off. Because I remembered the raw milk from when
cream
I was...
Cream is the best part.
Yeah, it's the best part. That it was just thick. Of course, we had tons of steak, and you would you know, put lard in the pan to cook your bacon, and hopefully it wasn't cut with cottonseed oil at the time, you know, because we raised our own pigs, and we had, you know, so we had our own lard, and so we knew what we were eating. But nonetheless, I gained probably 20 pounds in 6 months when I went back there. Part of that was I finally went through puberty. I was a late onset puberty because my body didn't have the sleep and the nutrition that it needed to let the hormones start to act. And I did a podcast or a Rhino's Rant about this, where I talked about, is your child's healthy diet stunting their growth? And I talked about how important it is that they get cholesterol. And I know that we talk a lot about as adults, your body can manufacture enough cholesterol. Well, as children, that's not necessarily the case. And so you need to be consuming animal foods. And I talked about farm-fed, those big farm-fed Oklahoma, you know, football player boys that are all 6'5", 320. Those guys are eating, you know, bacon and meat from their cow and raw milk, you know, and they're eating that, and eggs, whole eggs every day. And they're, you know, they're just fully developed, you know, monstrous people from those diets. So how does a hard gainer gain weight? Again, I stick with the whole eggs, the red meat, the ruminants. And then I try and bring fats down and drive carbs up because I'm using the hypertrophy training stimulus. I'm trying to fuel that. Again, you earn your carbs. The workload drives the process. And so in that specific case of trying to build muscle mass, I want to get in more hypertrophy training sessions every week, and I'm fueling that with tons and tons of carbs. I believe there's a bit of an anabolic benefit from all the water, the sodium, the glycogen when training. So that's
we want them to be hungry. So that's the other reason why protein is bad.
That's a huge one. And I'll say on that, when I'm eating steak, I can't eat as much as when I'm eating ground beef. And when I'm throwing bone broth in with my rice, now I can shovel down a ton of food as opposed to eating a steak and a side of rice. I can eat almost twice as much food when I put the bone broth in there and blend it all up and make it into a mash and put some scrambled eggs in there and mash it all up. That's kind of our trademarked meal is the monster mash. It's a blend of those things that's really easy to eat and tasty. The bone broth is a big one for us.
Glycine, love it.
Love it. And also, I'll have the guys and myself included, when I was doing a side of rice, because I'm trying to, again, get in more. I think Hofthorpe takes in 1,200 grams of white rice a day, almost 5,000 calories of just white rice. I build the foundation with you know, the micronutrient-dense foods. He has some fruit. He has some potato. Get the potassium. Get a whole array of foods so he has the micronutrients. But then just to drive calories, to fuel his workload and his mass, I got to be careful about his digestion. I can't load him full of tons and 5,000 calories of oatmeal.
Right.
Or bread.
Right.
You know, or pasta.
Because of.
Or pancakes.
Anti-nutrients, phytic acid, gluten.
Bloating, gas, diarrhea. Yeah, all of that.
Some carbs are better tolerated than others.
Some carbs are better, particularly if it's for that specific purpose in his regard.
And he's trying to gain the massive amount of weight.
He's like, trying so right to now support we're talking, a massive amount of weight and workload.
Right now we're talking about weight gain.
Yeah, weight gain. So another trick that I use in addition to the Monster Mash is I'll sprinkle some dextrose on my white rice. Not to drive calories, but for amylase and so it's easier to eat. Now you can eat a massive amount of it. And again, this is the workload drives the process. You have to earn these carbs. I'm training twice a day now under this scenario. Now I don't eat very many carbs. I cut my white rice out for a couple of months, as a matter of fact. I went with almost no carbs. I had a piece of fruit and a potato daily, potassium mainly. But I took out all the white rice because I don't have the same workload I used to. I train maybe 4 hours a week. I'm traveling a lot. So I'm not training 3 hours a day like I used to.
So tell me if I can summarize this. It seems like to me, if someone's a hard gainer, they need to eat. They need calories. And kind of like we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, I love how this is coming full circle. If they just try and eat a whole lot of calories in general, they might end up gaining fat. If they eat fat and carbs, they might just end up gaining fat. Nobody just wants to gain fat, right? You said, I mean, sometimes if people are actually just trying to be a sumo wrestler, fine, you can gain fat. But most of us want to gain muscle. And so I think that in order to gain muscle, and tell me if you agree with this paradigm, we have to get a caloric surplus. Yeah. And that caloric surplus is either going to come from fat or carbs. We can't get a caloric surplus of protein. We know that protein overfeeding doesn't happen. But if we try and eat fat and carbs together, we're going to get fat. So if we want to get muscle gains, we've either got to do extra carbs or extra fat, but not carbs and fat together. So we either need to do low fat, high carbs, kind of like what you're describing. Yeah. But I also wonder, and I think people could do this, you could do the reverse where you do X amount of protein, 1 gram per pound of lean body weight and overeat fat without the carbs. Do you think that would work?
You may run into an issue with that because now you're dealing with a lot more satiety. And so that's one of the other reasons why we drive the carbohydrates. And something, I don't know if Stan mentioned it or not, we'll have people actually drink their fruit because that'll stimulate a little bit more appetite and hunger.
Drink their food?
Fruit.
Fruit. Okay.
Yeah. So
I don't even know if we're going to talk about fruit. Part two.
Right. Yeah. If they're, instead of eating an orange, let's say, we would have them drink the orange juice with no pulp because we want less fiber, stimulate appetite, get them going. So really driving that. Because I think if you really... Even if you keep them at that 1 gram per pound of protein and you try to drive fat, I think you're just going to run into a big obstacle with that satiety.
And that's also a lever for this, for weight loss, right? Is that fat is so satiating. But I think that if we can figure out, people always say, can I gain weight on a carnivore diet? And I say, yes, I think you can. If you eat 1 gram per pound of protein and you get excess fat. And then I think the problem that a lot of people run into is we're just not used to eating a lot of fat in our diet.
Right.
But
or more so than that, they've demonized it.
Right.
They've learned that
there's not a lot of fat sources out there.
Yeah, they learned that a ribeye is bad for you and whole eggs are bad for you.
Right.
They've been told, and cheese is bad for you.
So right.
That's the main reason. They could get plenty of fat if they thought they were allowed to eat those foods and still be healthy.
But I think that you still, I mean, my feeling is that you still can gain weight in a ketogenic fashion, you know? And this is the question that's kind of revolving.
Oh, certainly, yeah. You can gain weight in a surplus. Damon just mentioned in terms of ease, we talked about, you know, when people go on a diet to lose weight, two of the main reasons that they go off the diet, that they rebound, which is the vast majority of people who lose weight, is hunger and energy. They get hungry and they get tired. And we try and mitigate those. Sodium's a big one for,
huge.
You know, it's huge for energy. And it's also huge, sodium, potassium together, for suppressing cravings. People don't realize how effective that is. So with the weight gain, one of the things we're trying to do is increase appetite or, you know, have more appetite available. And you mentioned the orange juice. We throw it in just a few ounces, 3 or 4 ounces with each of 3 meals a day, and it really makes you hungry. As opposed to eating an orange, which is a high satiety food. A potato is a high satiety food. I would not include potatoes in a weight gain diet. Or if I did, it would be the last meal of the day before bed, at which time you'd have plenty of time to get hungry for breakfast. So I'm real cautious about which foods I pick for that particular reason, not because I'm, you know, think that they're necessarily healthier or less healthy than some alternatives, but just for behavioral reasons.
Yeah, and I think you can leverage it and people can flip it around. If you want to lose weight, don't eat those foods.
Yeah, I'm cutting and chewing on steak when I want to lose weight.
Right.
Because it takes you longer to eat. Well, plus we know that it's damn hard to not lose weight eating a ton of steak
every day. It's pretty hard to not lose weight. And I want to highlight something you said earlier about a protein-sparing modified fast, which is what you were describing, which is almost synonymous with rabbit starvation, right?
Right.
If people want to lose weight, a very effective way to do that is to, if they want to lose weight and maintain lean muscle mass, the most effective way that I can think of to do that is to cut fat, cut carbohydrates and give yourself 1 or 1.2 grams per pound of body weight and do resistance exercise to give the muscle the stimulus.
Yeah.
And they'll be hypocaloric. Now, you can't do this long term because that equals hypogonadism and hormonal collapse. This is the chicken and broccoli diet.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can't do this long term, but if people want to lose weight, you can do essentially a protein sparing modified fast where you have a lot of protein, very little fat, very little carbohydrates, and your body will pull off the weight, and you give it a stimulus and you maintain muscle mass, right?
Yeah, correct. And there's no magic trick. I mean, there's no all you can eat diet. There's just a matter of whether or not one is more satiating than the other. It works for you necessarily. But the big thing that I get concerned about is that people have to understand that as they lose weight, they're going to burn fewer calories. All of the thermic effect of food, the non-exercise activity thermogenesis, your exercise activity thermogenesis, and then your basal metabolic rate. Those things will all start to decline just as a matter of less body mass. Metabolic adaptation is unavoidable. It's going to be some, you know, ratcheting down of your calorie burn for a host of different reasons that I just covered, your energy balance equation. But can you employ certain strategies to make that less difficult on you? And that's what we're trying to be careful of with satiety, with even with non-exercise activity thermogenesis. I do the 10-minute walks post meals. I'll get a lot of clients that come to me and they've cut out about all the calories that I'm willing to tolerate, and they've probably doing all the cardiovascular exercise that I would ever recommend. And they say they still want to lose a few more pounds. They've got a wedding coming up or a show around the corner. And usually what I'll do is have them, A, get more sleep. Get an extra hour or two of sleep if you can, if at all possible. B, stay on your feet all day. Non-exercise activity. The adaptation for losing weight with non-exercise activity thermogenesis is to sit more. The same thing happens. I don't throw aggressive training programs at people who are trying to, average folks who are trying to lose weight, because compensation takes effect whereby they come home and they sit more and they eat more. You get hungrier and right. You get tired, and now you've completely obliterated any benefit from that 1 hour of hard training that you just did. So I tell them to stay on their feet all day, sleep more, stay on their feet all day, and turn the temperature down in the house, turn the AC on high. And that will actually have an additional benefit for thermogenesis, for your body increasing its own metabolic rate. A fourth one I threw in recently, which seemed to work pretty well. The feedback I got from the client was good. I had someone dieting down for a weight cut. I had them put on a weight vest. They put on a 30-pound weight vest and stayed active all day long. And they did actually lose the extra pound that we were hoping for.
Perfect.
Yeah. So those are the big things that I throw at folks.
And maybe we could transition a little bit to training as we wrap up here, because I think a lot of people would benefit from your vast amount of knowledge on this. I've heard you say you're not a fan of like chronic cardio. Neither am I.
Not at all.
And I love what you said on other podcasts, that if you're trying to gain muscle and you're trying to do endurance cardio, those are completely different things. And we're talking upper body, lower body, right?
Yeah.
So, but you know, what do you think in terms of aerobic activity for people in general? You know,
general people, not athletes.
Right.
Athletes, of course, are going to have additional demands. But for general people, I think that they should meet, a healthy cardiovascular level of fitness, which we measure with VO2 max, and we look at about what 7 metabolic equivalents is seems to be a measurable amount to improve all cause mortality and health outcomes. That's not
being able to do 7 METs of work.
Yes, 7 METs of work.
Equivalent of like
a 13-minute mile.
Or going up a flight of stairs.
4 flights of stairs without getting winded, right in there.
Right.
That's not a huge demand. About 150 minutes a week right now is the recommendation. ACSM's recommendation, moderate. So I use the 10-minute walks because they have additional benefits. If you get a brisk walk and swing your arms, you can get pretty damn close to 7 METs. I use that for a bunch of other additional benefits. Yes. One, it's sustainable. If I get a client and I assign them 40 minutes on a treadmill 5 days a week, that's never going to happen long term, right? It's not a lifestyle. And I always say, what's the best exercise? The one you'll do. So if there is some activity they enjoy, do that. In the absence of that, my recommendation is the 10-minute walks post-meal. Again, we talked about blood sugar control, improves digestion, both the enzymatic activity and the muscle contraction. And then thirdly, it can give you an adequate amount of cardiovascular fitness. And it's easy to do and comply with. You know, I travel all over and I'm constantly, I'll walk around the airport or I'll get up in the morning at the hotel and walk around the hotel or go down to their little room and ride the recumbent bike, you know, and try and just get my heart rate elevated. And after each of at least three meals a day, I've been doing this for at least 3 years now. I started doing something similar to this when I was competing for a very specific reason. I was doing a heavy squat day on Sundays and we would squat over 800 pounds. I would find that for the next 3 days, I would be trying to rest. I would lay around a lot. My delayed onset muscle soreness would extend. I was really tired and achy and sore. So after reading some research at the time, I thought that the frequency of movement and just getting the blood flowing would be more effective than just laying around.
Consistency.
Obviously. Consistency. So I got a recumbent bike and I put it in my hotel room at the time where I was training in Sacramento with Mark Bell back in 2009. And after Sunday's hard workout, Monday morning, I would wake up and I would do a 10-minute kind of little HIIT session. I would do 30 seconds and then rest 30 seconds. And just like that, I would get a lot of blood flow and it was all concentric movement. So I wasn't breaking down any muscle tissue, no eccentric loading. But it would pump a ton of blood through my legs. And I would do that 3 times a day. The frequency matters, and the research suggests on the 10-minute walks that the frequency matters. 3 a day is better than 1 30-minute at the end of the day.
That's key.
They've looked at all-cause mortality research in terms of sedentary people versus sedentary with one exercise bout at the end of the day, and they were pretty equivalent. The people who moved more frequently throughout the day had a dramatic improvement in all-cause mortality. So the 10-minute walks are my recommendation for cardiovascular fitness. And then if you train, hypertrophy train, which everybody should, for the, you know, particularly the axial loading for the bone mineral totally density agree. And the muscle retention, as we kicked off the whole thing with, we recommend the training. You can get a much greater, much higher heart rate elevation from the training itself. If you just superset a couple synergistic body parts, you do a dip and rest a minute and do a chin up and rest a minute. That workout's going to elevate your heart rate for an extended period of time throughout the workout. And then we have, of course, have the post-workout, the EPOC, the excess post-exercise oxygen consumption. So you're going to get a significant benefit from the weight training, presuming you find, exercises that you enjoy, because it has to be a lifestyle.
Yeah, I think I agree with all that. I think that I love this idea of consistency and frequency. And I think that one of the things that I've noticed recently, I'm in this, you know, kind of bachelor pad that we're hanging out in now, and I've tried to put some workout stuff here. You know, I've got my X3 bar, shout out to John Jaquish.
Yep, in your bag.
I've got my punching bag. I've got a little pull-up bar over there. I've got an iron neck, shout out to those guys. You know, I've got a movement space. And, you know, I'm here most of the time developing content, podcasting, writing, you know, and then I'll take a little bit, take 20 minutes out or 15 minutes out and move a little bit or jump around, do some like jumps or squats or, and I find that like moving throughout the day is better than concentrating it all at one point in the day.
Yeah.
And that's more ancestrally consistent,
yes,
right? Like
of course.
rather than doing one thing where I'm just going to do like 1 hour at the gym and I'm doing all my stuff in that 1 hour.
Yeah.
I kind of like spreading it out. And I love that you're talking about that with 10-minute walk.
It's important. The frequency matters. And we look at the Amish. You know, I've read a bunch of research about the Amish. And when I lived in Pennsylvania for that period of time, we used to drive up to Lancaster and we'd get cheese from the Amish. And it was just the most amazing thing you've ever tasted. And those folks, they walk 20,000 steps a day. They eat bacon and ham and molasses. And, you know, they consume a significant amount of animal fats and foods that they grow themselves and raise themselves. They have about 3% obesity and about 60% of the cancer rate is the general population. There's no seed oils and back to seed oils.
Oh, that's seed oil.
Ding. Yeah. In their, you know, communities and their diets, they move a lot and they move longer throughout life into their older age. And so they have really excellent health outcomes, what people would seem to considering their diet, which we think is excellent, but most folks would beg to differ.
I don't think we need 45 minutes a day on the stair stepper ourselves. You know, I don't think we need an hour on the treadmill.
And it feels amazing. Mid-afternoon, you kind of get that little lull, and I saw on the internet somewhere this trick that somebody was using to motivate you. They just start doing counting from 5 to 1, you go 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, and then you jump up and you do whatever it is you were determined to do. And I have to do 3 to 1 because if I start at 5, I'm never going to get there. I have a short attention span of a gnat. So I just do, if I'm starting to get tired, if I'm reading or I'm working and I start to do this, 3, 2, 1, I stand up, I take a 10-minute walk. man, it charges your battery. It's insane. You come back and I'm fully back on it and I can, you know, go. And but I do it at least 3 times a day after meals. If I go to a restaurant, like tonight, we'll go eat. As soon as I walk out the door of the restaurant, I'm going to set my timer for 5 minutes and I'm just going to walk down the street until the timer goes off and I'm going to turn around and walk back before I get in my car.
Right.
I do that consistently every day. And I take my daughter to school in the morning. I'm always like, come on, guys, see how fast it. They're like, Dad, wait,
Seven minutes.
Yeah. And I get off the airplane and Damon knows I'm gone. It's an Olympic event for me. I'm racing.
Oh, I'm doing the same thing in airports.
As fast as I can go. Yeah. And people are all standing around waiting for their bags and I'm walking around, you know, bigger it's the airport, the better. Level. Yeah. And I've got a good pace going. I'm swinging my arms.
Yeah.
I'm breathing a little bit. To me, that is actually a workout. That's my cardiovascular training. I get at least 210 minutes a week, every single week.
It's perfect. And I think, you know, evolutionarily, maybe occasionally once a week, we throw in a sprint, but I think that's overdue.
Yeah, I love to run. I run stairs because I'm too big to do a track because the decelerating force is just too much load for me.
We need to show you how to do a 4 foot strike, my friend.
I need to work on that.
We need a 4 foot
sprint
strike.
Stairs.
Yeah,
perfect. I'll go run stairs because it's really low impact for me. I'll walk down, but I'll sprint up. And I do like that elevated heart rate.
I like it every once in a while. But I used to run ultra marathons. I had the chronic cardio disease and I was brainwashed forever. And now I just really like feeling good most of the time and not feeling overtrained and not feeling exhausted all the time.
Yeah.
And just getting a few, maybe 1 or 2 days a week where I do something really intense. And the rest of the time it's like constant low level stuff.
I have to say, because it's in keeping with my seed oil campaign, anti-seed oil campaign,
which
you just mentioned, the ultramarathon. Dr. Peter Attia did the endurance swimming from LA to what was it, San Juan Islands?
Catalina,
yeah. And for many years, and of course, he talks about the fact that eventually, because he was drinking a gallon of Gatorade a day and eating loaves of bread to try and fuel that workload, and he said eventually he found that he developed some central adiposity. And he had some muscle wasting, which would be common with endurance athletes. And so he had a little less muscle to draw that glycogen out of the bloodstream. And he started seeing his blood sugars elevate, as I remember the conversation. I've watched a number of his videos. And then after about a year later, I heard him talk about a video where he was talking about how many vegetables he used to eat, how many salads, because he used it as a vehicle to consume oil for the fats, for the calories that he needed. He was putting a ton of oils on. I was thinking olive oil would potentially be what he was using.
Probably.
Which I don't contend is a bad oil necessarily, but I don't think in the absence of the vitamin E from the actual olive that it's ideal in terms of creating that oxidative stress. You know, when you eat nuts, you got vitamin E associated with that, and so there's a little bit of antioxidant with the oxidative stress, but with the oil, I started to see something different. The Gatorade and the bread, sure, but in conjunction again with a vegetable oil, seems to create the perfect storm that then causes the fatty liver and subsequently the high triglycerides, which then now you've got your high blood sugars. It's a process of dominoes. I see somebody with decent blood sugars but high triglycerides. In my mind, it's right around the corner. It's coming your way.
Triglyceride HDL ratio is king.
Yeah.
And even olive oil, I'm not a fan of. I don't think any of the vegetable oils that are processed are a good idea because you're stripping it away. And that I think the vitamin E is more important than vitamin C. And that's a whole separate conversation.
It's still easier to oxidize than saturated fats.
It's way easier. It's monounsaturated. It's got a double bond. And you know, what's the vitamin E content of olive oil? It's not the same as an olive.
No.
And there are studies that show that even with olive oil, you can get postprandial endotoxinemia or endotoxemia. Yeah. So, you know.
Don't agree with me. Damon's going to punish me all the way home in the car. He's like, oh, you got with that seed oil stuff again. He'll call me a zealot and I'll be.
I totally
next
agree.
You know,
I think that
yeah,
liquid
Lane
fats,
Norton will have me on Friday fuckery, you know. Stan the seed oil zealot.
I hope we get on Lane Norton's video. I hope we get on Lane Norton's video. No, I'm not a fan of stripping oils away at all. And it's also a reason I'm not a fan of, I have to actually look at the data here, but I'm generally not a fan of rendered, even animal fat. I want the real fat. I want the trimmings. I want the fat on the steak. I don't want to process the fat. Don't strip it away.
Right.
Because I know that grass-fed animal fat and even grain-fed animal fat is rich in vitamin E, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to lose any of that vitamin E when I'm rendering the fat or anything. I want all of those nutrients and I don't want to process the fat at all. I want the most unprocessed fat that I can get.
we, in order to get rid of the seed oils, but still be able to make, because I own a meal prep company, the Vertical Diet has a meal prep company, and we serve meals nationwide, and we make them in a, without any seed oils. It was really hard for us to source eggs without seed oils, because, you know, in these mass production, you get 5-gallon buckets of eggs, same way they do at Denny's or at IHOP. Well, those eggs are adulterated with seed oils. People don't realize that. Whether you cook them in it or not, they're already in there. It's one of the reasons why I couldn't figure out for so many years. I have a particular, I'm allergic to seed oils, canola and corn oil and the like. I'll get diarrhea. I get really bad gastric distress to the point where sometimes I can't even hardly make it to the bathroom. It's painful. And I did a video about where I talked specifically about that one time. When I started my meal prep company, I partnered with a meal prep provider. I went in and sat down with them, and we sourced all the ingredients, and I was very careful to say that everything couldn't have. It took them almost 2 months to find an egg provider that didn't have, that wasn't adulterated. The same thing is true with lard, adulterated with cottonseed oil for so many years.
Yeah.
And the same thing's true with some of the tests that they perform on rats using lard as compared to seed oil. There's seed oil in the lard.
Oh yeah,
the tests aren't even valid. This is some great stuff you can talk to Tucker Goodrich about when you have him on your show. But the point being is that we cook our spinach and peppers for some of the meals in grass-fed, grass-finished beef tallow. We make bone broth, boiling grass-fed, grass-finished bones and joints as well, to make sure we get, because a lot of people just do the long bones and don't get adequate collagen. We have 10 grams of protein per serving in our bone broth. But we cook all of our meals that way with absolutely no seed oils in any of our food or in the preparation process. Bone broth, we blend in our monster mash with the rice, so it's real moist. This is an advertisement for Vertical Diet.
Yeah, well, it's okay.
At theverticaldiet.com. But the point being is this is the way I eat. This is the way I wanted to prepare my food for clients.
I love it. It's making it accessible for people.
Yeah.
And in part two, we're going to have to get you guys back on and talk about fructose and spinach.
Yeah, I know. Oxalates and all that stuff.
Because need to go to steak dinner. But so we should wrap up. But I mean, I think that a lot of people will love to hear a part two. So hopefully I can get you guys back on and we can talk about the nuance there. I think we covered a lot of great stuff. Where can people find your stuff and find out more about you?
At Stan Efferding is about everything. StanEfferding.com is my website. At Stan Efferding on Instagram. I've got a YouTube account with all of those rhinos rants is Stan Efferding. That's the best place. TheVerticalDiet.com is a direct source to the meals. Mm-hmm. StanEfferding.com will also get you there through a link. So that's where you find us. And then, of course, Damon McCune is my partner in crime here. And you can always DM me or Damon if you have questions. We've taken 50 to 100 questions a day via DM, email, or text over the last 18 months, probably 50,000 different messages. We try and respond to most of them. But
it's a valiant effort, my friend.
It's been extraordinary. It's hard. Damon, no, I spend hours every time I'm on a plane, on flights, trying to respond to people. You know, just a brief response, attach an article, because we get a lot of questions about all the things you've been talking about on your show and about the all of the misinformation that's out there. And so, we've had a really good chance to, I think, get a lot of good, testimonials. As they are, our experience. And when we talk about something, we've not only applied it to ourselves, but we've seen it happen with thousands and thousands of people all over the world and been able to intervene and get, a good result. And so we're, really
happy. Results speak for themselves. You know, it's fantastic. So the last question I always ask people on the podcast is, what is the most radical thing? This is like 80s radical that you have done in the last month. And you guys can both tell me. What's the most radical thing you've done in the last, recently, Damon? This is 80s radical, Def Leppard. This is like, I'm going to give you the soundtrack for radical.
So I guess last week we went to Five Finger Death Punch concert with 3 Days Grace and Fire from the Gods and Bad Wolves.
I love
it. It was great. It was a great concert.
Did you go to Mosh Pit, Five Finger Death Punch?
No, but it was intense. It was at the joint at the Hard Rock, which I don't know if you know, but the Hard Rock in Las Vegas is sold. So they are now owned by Virgin Records. So they're actually converting all that the first of the year. So this is one of the last concerts they were going to have at the joint. So
I thought that was a good concert.
It was great.
I mean, if people are not familiar with Five Finger Death Punch, you should check them out if you like metal. If you don't like metal, maybe don't. Gently approach five.
Exactly.
Minutes. I like it. It's intense.
And they're a Las Vegas local band. So that was actually a pretty cool
thing. Awesome. I know I've got some friends listening to this who will like Five Finger Death Punch.
Yeah. Well, I wish I had a story like that. I don't. I'm such a creature of habit. My OCD has me on such a great schedule. I've always loved training. I'm 52 years old. About the most radical thing I do is I crawl under a 600-pound squat every week, and I just love it. It's the feeling I get from that. We just got done doing it a couple hours ago down there at Strength Cartel with Big Boy, before that in Russia last month when I was there in Moscow, they said, "Do you want to go to the Red Square?" I'm like, "No." "Do you want to go here?" "No." "You want to go there?" "No." "Where's the gym?" And so I partnered up with one of the lifters there when we went down to the gym, and I was looking around for Andrei Milanichev and, you know, to see if I could see any of the guys that I love to watch lift, Mikhail Kokleev. I did meet up for dinner with Kirill Sarkev, who was the former 735-pound world record bench presser. Just a monster of a man. But those things to me are exciting, to sit down and talk to those people and listen to their story about how they reach their success. I learned so much from so many people over the years, but the most radical thing I still do, pain-free, by the way, I have, after 10 years of chronic tendonitis, I've healed all of my joints, probably because I got rid of the damn seed oils and threw in vitamin D and sodium, and I feel fantastic, and I squat with no pain every week. I jump under a 600-pound squat, and I squat it, and I don't hurt at all. I feel fantastic. No hip pain, no knee pain, no back pain, none of that. And I've been through many injuries throughout my career, and I feel grateful that the body is regenerative, not degenerative, and that if you give it the right stimulus and you take care of it, that it's going to continue to perform for many, many years.
I love it. That's such a great way to end the podcast, that, and I'll echo what Stan says, that we can be regenerative. If we give the body what it needs and we take away the inflammatory impediments, yep, I believe that we can regenerate and become Steve Austin.
Yeah.
You're pretty close, dude. You guys are both pretty close. So, I mean, everything you guys do is radical. So thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for
having me. It's been a pleasure. And now we get to all go eat steak.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right, you guys, that was a fun one. It was really cool to sit down with these people, talk some biochemistry, talk about Stan's experiences training Halvtor Bjornsson, Brian Shaw, the strongest men in the world, for sure. I am not convinced that they could not do it without a ketogenic diet, but I think there would be a keto adaptation period, and a lot of athletes don't want to do that. I think when you're at that level of strength, we absolutely need to have lots of calories. We need to gain weight, and you know, what we know, for better or for worse, is that eating meat and fat is very satiating. So I think that if these athletes could get enough calories, it could work, and they probably would get tons more nutrients. My suspicion is that they would probably recover better. As we heard in the podcast with Chris Masterjohn, from an antioxidant perspective, I really believe that a ketogenic diet is protective for the brain. So basically, like I said in this podcast, I think people might be surprised at my perspective that we can thrive on carbs. I think it's totally possible. There are people in the world doing it. I just feel better on fat. I think that we have to really choose what macronutrient we need or we want to use. We can use fat or we can use carbs. But generally speaking, if we do high fat and high carbs, we may gain weight. And I think that there are people who lose weight eating high carb, and there are people who lose weight eating high fat, and they can both be viable. I think eating high fat is beneficial, more beneficial than eating high carb. We know there are dangers to eating high carb for some people. And I think that the research is still evolving here. It's not clear to me whether some people just can't tolerate carbs, or they're eating carbs with fat, or they're eating the wrong type of carbs. Certainly we know that processed carbohydrates, oxidized vegetable oils, are no bueno, and we want to avoid those. As Stan says, when he took them out of Halvtor's diet, he got much better. That was kind of a no-brainer, right? But I think that we know that animal foods are the best foods on the planet. Whether or not we include carbohydrates is up to you guys based on performance and your goals. What I'm trying to highlight with a lot of podcasts recently is that we can, I think, perform optimally on a ketogenic diet. It just requires a keto adaptation period. But once we do that, we are fat-burning men and women who are machines. Anyway, check out my stuff, you guys, Carnivore MD, to subscribe to the newsletter. You can go to thecarnivorecodebook.com to check out the book, pre-order. Thank you for your support. And you can also give this podcast a review. I would appreciate it. I will give you a virtual high five, or I will give you an in-person high five when I see you at KetoCon, my friends. All right, check out Stan's stuff, stanefforting.com. And I love and appreciate you all. Stay radical. Keep living the radical life.